welcome to the very first episode or podcast of the Silmarillion Film Project of 2018.
That's right.
I am your co-host, Dave Kale, and that is my son, Wallace Kale, in the background. You can probably hear making noises and kicking and looking at me and trying to talk to me. But I'm also joined, in addition to Wallace, joined by Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor. Happy New Year to you, Corey.
Happy New Year to you.
And I'm excited. We're back to the Noldor this episode, right?
That's right. Yeah, burning the ships today. It's a big big day. Today is the one that we had pegged as sort of the big turning point of the season. This is when things start to get actually tragic. I mean, not that the kinslaying wasn't tragic at the beginning of the season, but we had the first two episodes, which where things were bad, right? You know, the Oath of Fëanor is bad and the kinslaying is bad, but those are bad in the sense of like we're setting off on this really bad trajectory, right? That was the making of the really bad decision. Today is the time when we get to that real point of no return, when Fëanor goes completely off the edge. I have always thought that the kinslaying was, or even more than the kinslaying, the burning of the ships is really the moment when Fëanor really kind of seals things for himself, because the kinslaying. Go ahead.
I was going to say the kinslaying. You can kind of understand as sort of things got out of control.
Right. Right. And yeah. I mean, again, I'm not trying to take anything away from the kinslaying and how bad that was, but the other thing that I would say about it is the doom of Mandos. You know, I mean, like that. Finarfin turns back, right, and is forgiven. And to me, I think that there is this sense that that's like the last chance to repent, right? They could have, had everybody, including Fëanor, turned back and, gone back and sought forgiveness, I think they could have gotten it, you know? But the choice to not only go on, but then to actually begin to enact the betrayals that were foretold in the Doom of Mandos, he's done. He's done at that point. So yeah. this is a really big deal.
There's an intentionality to the burning of the ships
Yes.
Like I said, the kinslaying kind of seems like, can be understood as like, oh, they didn't mean for things to get that bad. There was a misunderstanding.
Misunderstandings, escalations. Yeah. Mistakes
with
were made.
The ships is just like, yeah, all right, we're not sending the ships. He's also doing it to his own even closer kin.
Yes, who have done nothing against him other than follow him. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
It also seems slightly more. It seems like more of a jerk move too. Like it's hard to understand why are they burning those ships? Like, why can't you send those ships back? It just seems like just sort of mustache twirly evil, or jerky. So yeah, I think that's really where like things turn.
Yeah. And it's really, of course, that's one of our biggest challenges here today is to like, how do we explain Fëanor's choice to burn the ships? How do we depict that choice without just making him look like an utter lunatic who's just acting arbitrarily, you know, because it, from a rational standpoint, it seems to make no sense at all. It's our job today to try to make it make sense, but also to make sure that we're capturing its position. Cause right after this, things start to go downhill, right? The next episode, episode 9, is battles, right? And so we're going to get the slaughter of the Green Elves next time. We're going to get the apparent, at least short-term, victory of Fëanor and the Noldor against the Orcs and what's, I almost said Bulldog, but he's down in the south, Gothmog up in the north. It's going to be battles, death of Denethor, then the death of Fëanor, and, you know, it's going to think, and you know, and then we're going to get the Girdle of Melian. So things are getting bad after this, right? Things get real. I mean, they've already been real, but this is a big deal. So anyway, yeah, it's a big episode today. I'm looking forward to ironing out some of this stuff. As I said, I've always found the burning of the ships one of the most sort of compelling and just crucial moments in the whole career, certainly of Fëanor, but really of the Noldor, you know, of the sort of the history of the Noldor. So I'm really looking forward to thinking it through and seeing what we can do when we're actually trying to envision it here. So that is our.
Sadly,
go ahead.
The bad news about today is by Trish.
Yes. Unfortunately, Trish couldn't make it here today. So yes, we are Trishless here today. Yeah, that is the sad thing. Quick announcements as we attempt, nevertheless, to move forward. Hang on, I've got my announcements page. Here we go. Okay, two main announcements. Mythmoot early bird registration. This is a very urgent announcement. So the early bird registration ends this Sunday, January 7th. So if you've decided to come to Mythmoot this year, you might want to act on that sooner rather than later. Our ticket prices will go up a little bit after the 7th of January. So I encourage you to look into that. We've got a bunch of registrations already. It's looking like a great time. We have John Garth and Douglas Anderson both coming this year, as well as Mark Ockren, the inventor of the Klingon language. So it's going to be a great time this year. Also, the Mythmoot call for papers is up. So if you want to give a paper, if you want to propose, you know, another kind of session, we're pretty flexible with different things that happen there. You can totally do that. We have the call for papers on the webpage. So again, just go to signumuniversity.org and then click on the Mythmoot image icon down there. A little bit down the page, and it will get you to the Mythmoot page, and the call for papers is linked on a button in the middle of that page. So that's Mythmoot. Don't forget Mythmoot, June 21st to 24th of 2018. And then spring courses, our second announcement, our spring courses start soon. We've got some great courses this year. We're rerunning my Tolkien's poetry course, which I taught for the first time back in 2014, I think it was, summer of 2014. So that was that class was so much fun. Really excited to see that course going again. Anyway, so cool. All right. Those are our quick announcements. Now, a couple housekeeping items. So the message board was discussing the question that we put a couple weeks back about the Amazon project and what we do with the Amazon project. They want to continue with season 4 of Silm Film. We'll reevaluate that. We'll see what happens when we get to, you know, we're not going to do anything before the end of season 3. We're obviously going to continue and finish season 3. So we have several more months of what we're currently doing before we make that final decision. So we'll see kind of where we are and what news has come out by the time we get to that point. We'll see. I don't know. Go ahead.
Be forewarned. Your fearless podcast hosts are more inclined toward jumping. But the warning was that that you and I are more inclined toward jumping on the bandwagon, Amazon show bandwagon.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for me to imagine just sort of carrying on like we've been carrying on and sort of more or less pretending that, like, what is probably going to be the biggest, you know, Tolkien news of the decade isn't happening. Like, that's going to be hard to do, I think. I mean, it's hard. I mean, goodness knows I love what we're doing and I would love to continue. And anybody who knows me even a little bit knows how much I dislike in anything jumping ahead and skipping to a later thing. I can't even, like, so recently I decided I've been in my nocturnal house cleaning movie watching thing, you know, so I always watch something, like I that's how I catch up with Netflix shows and things, is that I watch them while I do dishes and stuff at night. And I just finished watching Babylon 5, which was great. I never saw Babylon 5, and many people have told me that I have to watch it, and it was awesome. I absolutely loved Babylon 5. But I just finished that. So I was looking around for, okay, what do I watch next now that I finished Babylon 5? And I noticed, I was like, oh, hey, man, I'm like two or three seasons behind on Doctor Who now. I watched Doctor Who, finally, the new Who, a couple years back and caught up on that. But I'm behind now. But I can't just jump to, like, season 8 or 9. Like, I can't do that. I had to start at season 1 and go all the – and now I'm going all the way through so that I can get up to there and be prepared for it when I get to season 8, 9, and 10. So, yeah, like, that's me. I can't – even when I'm rewatching something, even when I've seen it before, I can't do that. So it totally goes against my own grain to jump ahead. But at the same time, this is sort of too big an opportunity, and I don't want to. I'm very reluctant to sort of pass this up. I think that, kind of being a part of that moment, I think would be pretty awesome. But we'll see. Hey, you know, Phil is teasing me to saying, at least I didn't feel I had to go all the way back to the first Doctor and watch all the classic Who episodes. I was this close, Phil. I was absolutely this close. If they had been available on Amazon Prime, I totally would have. I absolutely would have. But they're not available on Amazon Prime. I've got to subscribe to something different. But I'm probably going to do that, actually. I've never seen the classic Who. And I was really excited to see that now, as they were not a couple years ago, the classic Who are now available. So, anyway, yeah. Had they been on Prime, I absolutely would have done that. Yeah, so we'll see. Hakan, I agree. It's not going to take that many years. The most recent speculation that I've heard is that the show is going to likely begin either late in 2019 or in 2020. So it's pretty close, you know. And we don't move that quickly, so you know we need to be prepared. But anyhow, okay. So let's. But the other thing, Philip Menzies would like someone to write lyrics for Melian's song to create the girdle. So that's great. Yeah, to have Melian's song, music and words, would be really, really neat. So yeah, if somebody wants to work with Philip Menzies, our resident film composer, to collaborate there on a song that Melian will sing, that would be awesome. I would absolutely love to hear that. So you can go to the discussion boards. The discussion boards are just at forums.mythgard.org, and you'll be able to see the film discussion board and get everything going there. So connect with Philip there and see what you guys can do. That would be great. All right. Good. Well, let's get to it then. Let's move on to Feanor. So, all right, couple things going on here. Several questions. A lot of things going on here that we're being prompted for in this slide. A lot of really interesting things to think about. Let's start first, because I think that the very first thing we have to do is really get inside Feanor's head, which is sort of an unpleasant place to be. But we need to understand... Feanor's mentality here. What is going through Feanor's mind? Why does he do what he does? As I was just saying a few minutes ago, it seems an entirely unreasonable thing to do. I mean, apart from the fact that it's a bad thing to do, right? Apart from the fact that it is a betrayal of his own kin, including his own half-brothers, Well, at least one brother. The other one's already left. What it seems imprudent as well. I mean, even from a purely cold calculating standpoint, it decreases his ability to make war on Morgoth, right? The host of Fingolfin is there because they chose to follow him, Feanor. So he is leaving behind people who have come to follow him, right? So it doesn't, it's, again, on one level, it doesn't make any sense. I think that there has to be a level of distrust there, right? He has to distrust them. And that they could be grumbling, right, as Håkon is suggesting, which I think is entirely sensible. Håkon says, after the doom, the people of Fingolfin curse Feanor and claim that he's brought disaster for everyone, so he won't feel liked by everyone and probably doesn't trust them. Yeah, exactly. The fact that he suspects they're going to turn on him, an increase of paranoia in Feanor seems like the sensible thing for us to do, right? That Feanor becomes increasingly paranoid that Fingolfin is going to turn on him. That he believes that, you know, maybe he's now saying, does he have a we have to give him a confidant, don't we? I mean, he needs to be able to articulate these things aloud, unless we're just going to have scenes with Feanor talking to himself or something. But I mean, we kind of need
one of his sons, maybe?
And how it would have to be one. Which one, though? Not Mithros, presumably, as Mithros is not in sympathy. And that scene where, you know, Mithros is like, so, whom shall we fetch back first? Fingon the Valiant, right? That's that scene's not going to happen if he's been in Feanor's confidence. So it's not Mithros.
Like maybe like a Corophon or, you know, one of the sons who seems most by their later actions are
right.
most alike him.
Right.
I think Wally agrees with this suggestion.
Yeah. Curufin, I would say Curufin is the one who seems to be most like, I mean, is the one who is the greatest craftsman of his sons, right? So that would be an easy way to sort of explain how Feanor, like why he would be sort of Feanor's favorite or Feanor's confidant. Feanor could have the most respect for him because of his, because of his crafting abilities, right? So I think I would, and Curufin we know, think also of the role that Curufin is going to be playing in the usurpation of Nargothrond as well, and the way that he speaks the words that he speaks and sways the crowd in a, you know, a rather sort of Feanorian fashion. So it's not that Curufin is going to step into the position of Feanor. You know, he's not the eldest and he's not going to be the leader after Feanor is dead. But I can see him being the confidant. I can't really see I can't really see any obviously better candidates. Murray, exactly. I think that we can show Curufin as being his father's yes man. I think that's a good way to think of it, right? It's not that he is singled out as his heir or something like that, but he's the one his dad talks to because he's the one who is sort of most like his dad. Anyway, again, one of them has to be his confidant. Go ahead.
I think we can exclude Maglor.
Yeah, we can clearly exclude. It has to be not Maglor or Mithros. That's the main important thing, and apparently not Amrod. So we that rules out Amrod and Amroth pretty much. So really, we're only left with Curufin, Carinthir, or Celegorm as the three options. Carinthir seems to be too much of a thug. Celegorm I would consider, but Curufin seems the obvious candidate, again, given the sort of similarities there. Yeah. So, okay. All right. So let's say Curufin. So he's talking to Curufin, And we have to show his developing paranoia. So he thinks that Fingolfin maybe... Is he going to be talking about... I mean, is he going to be talking about the Doom? Because, you know, the Doom foretold betrayal by kins, but, you know, of one kin to another. And is he going to be using that as an argument? Is he going to be saying, look, you know, we were told that we were going to be betrayed, and I always knew that that little weasel, Fingolfin, couldn't be trusted, and he's going to betray, if he comes over, he's going to betray us. He knows, for instance, the host of Fingolfin is larger than the host of Feanor. So there are more followers of Fingolfin than there are of the Feanorians. So,
that seems like the perfect setup, right? And that would be the perfect irony if Feanor, in the original scene, he apparently rejects the Doom of Mandos,
right?
But it's great if in the following scene he starts referencing it as reason for making certain decisions,
right?
And I think everything's teed up for him to be very suspicious of and nervous about Fingolfin. Like you said, he has the larger host and stuff. So
yeah,
I think he should definitely be citing the Doom, saying, "Hey, Mando said we'd be betrayed."
Yeah,
and Fingolfin already defied me once.
Yeah. I really like Nick was just saying, you know, of one thing the Lord of Death speaks true. Yeah, exactly. He shouldn't be like responding as if he got new information from the Doom, right? He doesn't rely upon it. He does reject it, and he holds himself above it. Exactly that line. I mean, just as in his own oath and his his speeches under torchlight in Tyrion back in episode one, he is speaking against Morgoth, and yet he is, you know, most of the things that he's saying have their origins in the lies that Melkor told. So here he's rejecting the Doom, and yet he's clearly, you know, also being influenced and guided by the Doom. The way that Fëanor would probably say it is that he always knew that treachery was coming, and he didn't need Mandos to tell him, right? But yet, nevertheless, like, it's clearly in the context of the Doom of Mandos that he's referring to this. So, So he's convinced that they're gonna. This must be so. How many conversations do we need? Like, how do we build this up? We have a because he the decisions he makes, right? First to leave. So, you know, the first is just the departure to sail across and to sail across in secret, right? To depart in secret, rather, from the coasts. And then second, to burn the ships once they get there. And
so I think that means there's at least two conversations.
I think so.
Leading up to each of those decisions.
You know, maybe.
And I kind of like the suggestion that in the PowerPoint that we have, that the decision about burning the ships should be prompted by somebody of good faith and goodwill saying, okay, well, let's turn the ships around and go back and pick up the Dolphins people.
Yes.
So I think maybe the decision about departing in secret could be prompted by sort of a confidential conversation between Feanor and Curufin.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, of course, the other thing we have to deal with here is not just the progress of this in Feanor's own mind, but the communication of it to others, right? How does he... So, because we not only have to get behind, get our minds around what Feanor is thinking during this process, but what is everybody else thinking? Like, so the Feanorians, like, what's up with the Feanorians? Why are they, you know... What is their reaction? Do we think that they are more along with Feanor, or do we think that more of them have a sort of a Mythros, Mythros reaction, and they're all shocked? Marie points out that they're on different ships, so we can show Feanor's host disjointed during the crossing. Yeah, I mean, he needs to communicate to them to go, and he has to communicate to them to go in secret, right? I mean, they all are going to leave before Fingolfin's people are aware that they've gone. And so that's going to require some some coordination. And that seems to need some explanation, doesn't it? You know, be like, okay, hey, everybody, we're going to sail over, but don't say anything to anybody. Just leave quietly. Like, how is that going to be explained? I mean, I guess it's true that they don't have to know that they're leaving in secret, I guess, but... But I don't know. I mean, how does an entire... How does the fleet leave by night, you know, without anybody... I don't think they can leave in secret without knowing that they're leaving in secret.
It sort of seems to be kind of a problem.
It does kind of seem to be a problem.
And if it's planned ahead and communicated to his whole host, how on earth is it kept secret?
Right. Right. I mean... He could.
Dr. Tolkien thought through the logistics of this.
Yeah, he could tell them, you know, like the other captains of the ships, that you know he could send out word to have them stand ready to depart, you know, at any minute. And yeah, Maria, I know they're already on the ships, so that's I'm not worried about that.
So here's a question. I wonder if maybe we, instead of making it sort of a secret, abrupt decision, maybe there's sort of a, maybe there's advanced planning that, you know, Feanor's host already controls the ship, so they'll go first.
Right.
And the part that's secret is the actual moment of departure, so that it's not weird that they leave by themselves, because that's what everyone expected to happen. But the fact that, you know, Fingolfin wakes up and Feanor's just gone and he didn't say he was leaving right that instant
right. Seems
ominous and weird. But it's not immediately a betrayal, maybe.
Yeah. I guess the reason I'm talking about, I mean, several people are asking why does it have to be secret? But I'm trying to find the passage. Okay, let's see. Therefore, it came into the hearts of Feanor and his sons to seize all the ships and depart suddenly, for they had retained the mastery of the fleet, and it was manned only by those who fought there and were bound to Feanor. And as though it came at his call, there sprang up a wind from the northwest, and Feanor slipped away secretly with all whom he deemed true to him, and went aboard and put out to sea and left Fingolfin and Ahriman. And since the sea there was narrow, right? He gets across. Then Fingolfin, seeing that Feanor had left him to perish in Ahriman or to return in shame to Valinor, was filled with bitterness. The reason I like this... So my point is not just, well, it says they slipped away in secret, so they have to be, is that I really like the effect of that. Like that moment when the host of Fingolfin wakes in the morning, you know, when dawn comes... And they look out and the ships are just gone, right? And they realize that's the first moment when they suspect, whoa, hang on, we've just been betrayed. We've just been abandoned. They might not know it for sure, right, yet. But I want to preserve that moment. You know, that moment seems to me a really important moment, and one that would be really powerful on screen, I think, just the sight. The sight of the, you know, of the coast, which had been covered in the ships of the Teleri, just empty. And the, you know, the people of Fingolfin looking around and saying, you know, what is, what's happening? What's going on? Yeah, we could take...
I agree, we need to preserve that moment.
We could take advantage of that wind thing, right? The sudden wind that comes up. That could fit also into Feanor's megalomania, right? So Feanor has made the decision to leave secretly. They all know they're going to leave, right? they've talked about it and they've decided, okay, we've been going north. We're far enough north. It's time to sail across soon. So everyone, even the host of Fingolfin, can be ready for that in a sense. The Fëanorians are all ready to depart. He decides, I want to leave them behind. I want to slip away before they even know that we're gone. And then the wind comes up, right? The wind comes up and starts blowing them all off shore anyway, right? And then he just takes advantage of the opportunity. So he what? Signals to them, right? So he would just have to signal to the other ships to go. How could he do that? Oh, he's got Palantiri, doesn't he? That's easy. No problem. No problem. Ship-to-ship communication is easy as anything. Right? Doesn't he? Didn't he make those already? Didn't we have those? No, he doesn't. Oh, he left those behind?
No, yeah. Oh. Why does he have to? Why can't he take them?
Hang on. So wait, Nick and Marie are both saying that he doesn't have those. Hang on, so they must have a good reason why he doesn't have those. Something that I'm forgetting. Okay, right. Okay, that's right. I'm remembering this now. Maria's reminding me that we did kind of confront this problem before, that if the elves of Beleriand have Palantiri available to them, it's going to super complicate the plots of the First Age. I mean, certainly, for instance, Marie, yeah, if Turgon had a Palantir and, you know, everybody else could just check in, like, hey, how are things in Gondolin? Oh, yeah, we're good. Thanks for checking in on us, right? Yeah, that's, it certainly utterly changes the stories later on. Yes, right, logistical nightmare. I agree, Nick. Okay. Signal. Well, we don't even need fires because we do have like awesome blue Noldor lamps, right? So they can signal to each other well enough.
How about that flag contraption that Azog was using in the Hobbit film?
Yes, they built an elaborate semaphore rig to communicate back and forth. Yeah, they can communicate by Fëanorian lamps. I think that would be fine. He makes his decision of what he wants to do. Then the wind comes up and starts blowing all the ships out. And then Fëanor sort of smiles and feels like, yes. So, you know, he seems to be operating under this vague idea that, like, the wind was summoned up by his own decision, right? That, like, he's, you know, his own will is controlling the elements or something. I think that he could be far enough gone into megalomania to have at least that kind of vague impression that, like, you know, obviously what he is doing is right because, you know, the world is
definitely supporting him. Significance into that.
Yeah, definitely. But see, it's hard because, of course, the significance he can't read into it is that Manway supports him, right? Because he doesn't need the support of the Valar, right? So it's all about him, right? This is his decision, and so like Arda itself is forming itself to support his will.
I am kind of curious, just as an aside, because I never really noticed that. The passage about the wind before, but what are we supposed to understand from that? Is it just like, I mean, are there circumstances where you have something like this, an important occasion, and the wind kicks in, which in other occasions we would say, aha, that's the Valar acting.
Yeah.
Are the Valar acting here, or is this just like, oh no, this is just
That's a great question, because I agree in every other circumstance. If this were, I mean, it's just like the wind from the sea that comes up to waft Aragorn's fleet up the Anduin, right? I mean, there's like does anybody have any suspicions that that wind was just a coincidence? Right? That wind wasn't just a coincidence. It's clear that that it is way too portentous, that wind.
This wind seems equally portentous.
Exactly. So. Except it's supporting a bad thing instead of a good thing.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And again, the...
It does kind of... I mean, I don't think... I think it can be in the sense that basically the Valar maybe recognize that Feanor is sort of on his path now, and that this is kind of what needs to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And though it, and as though it came at his call,
enabling betrayal.
Yeah, exactly. As though it came at his call. As though it came at his call, there sprang up a wind. The as though shows how he thought about it, right? But it also implies that it didn't actually come up at his call, right? Yeah, Hakon says it's like Manway asking Feanor a question. Will you use this wind? Yeah, I wonder. I wonder. I mean, it almost looks like, I don't know, a temptation, right? Is this Manway's version of what Galadriel did to the Fellowship, in a sense, right? So Feanor, what would you do if a favoring wind came up? Are you going to betray your brother? Is that what's going on here? Is this, if I enable this, are you going to do it? Like, is that what's happening here? I don't know. I mean, that doesn't really seem very Manway-like to do something like that, but it's really hard. Hakon is suggesting that, it sort of, and Nick was suggesting the same thing, that Manway might be trying to preserve Fingolfin, that it seems possible that Feanor might have killed him or tried to kill him had he come along. Maybe.
So Manway's trying to blow Feanor away.
Yeah, exactly. This is Manway saying, Do I have to separate you two? Fine. You know.
Actually I guess if you apply that frame to it, it now appears to be a beneficent act in the sense that, you know, like, look, Feanor is going to do what he's going to do, and there's sort of the sooner he's gone, the better. Maybe we could actually save Fingolfin from any further folly. I mean, maybe the hope is if we send Feanor away and the ships are gone, maybe Fingolfin will turn around.
Right.
I kind of wonder, can we take advantage of this to set up an interesting character moment for Fingolfin? Where we really show that we really play up the dilemma of the decision that he has to make, and maybe portray it as a situation where the Valar are actually hoping he will sort of turn around in shame and come back. And that becomes Fingolfin's big moment where nope, and the Valar are just like, ah, crap.
Right. So that it's not. So that unlike Feanor's own megalomaniacal assumption, the wind isn't all about him. It's actually about Fingolfin. It's sending Feanor, because Feanor has made his decision, and the Valar know Feanor has made his decision. He made that perfectly clear in his response to Mandos or whoever it was who delivered the doom. So, I mean, yeah, he made that really clear. So they send him off with the wind, leaving Fingolfin and giving him the choice. Because that choice, and that's one of the things that I definitely want to get to, is that choice by Fingolfin is a crucial one, obviously. The choice to go on and cross the Helcaraxa, that's a big deal. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Tony says it could also have been trying to save Fingolfin from the temptation to kill Feanor. Yeah, I mean, that the two of them might have come to blows seems likely. But, yeah, Yeah, as Hakon says, even if Feanor wouldn't have killed Fingolfin, he's bad company. Yeah, yeah, he is. And, like, bad company in the sense of being a bad influence, right? Like, you know, Fingolfin is running with the wrong crowd, and the Valar know it. I agree. These things, so putting Fingolfin in the place where he has to make an independent choice, not just following Feanor, because that's another major thing, right? He swore an oath that he would go wherever Feanor, that he would follow Feanor. And so he's following Feanor in pursuance of his oath. When he's abandoned, when Feanor has left him behind, he's clearly absolved of his oath, right? You know, Feanor has chosen to admit, if anything, you say, if he's going along with Feanor, if he's following his oath to go along with Feanor, he'll not go. Because Feanor told him not to, Feanor disinvited him from the trip to Middle-earth, right? Fairly actively, by abandoning him on the beach. So, there's a sense in which Fingolfin has not made his own totally independent choice to go. That's obviously not totally true. Finarfin, for instance, made the active choice to return, and Fingolfin didn't, and clearly could have. But, of course, Finarfin hadn't sworn that oath. Anyway, so the idea of giving Fingolfin that opportunity to make an independent call, what is he going to do? I think that that's... that kind of makes sense, actually. And Tony, I agree, it does make the deaths of the elves who cross even more tragic because they were given an opportunity to turn back. Yeah, absolutely. And makes even more sense of why the Valar don't help them when they're over there, right? Why the Valar shut the doors against them as firmly as they do. Because they chose, right? They had not only multiple chances to turn back, but they chose against great odds, right? In the face of great adversity, in the face of rejection and, you know, this very active disinvitation, right? They chose to go on anyway. They've definitely made the bed which the Valar are then allowing them to lie in, right? Yeah, Nick, we could have a scene early in the episode where Fingolfin considers the possibility he might have to stop Feanor. In fact, Nick, it occurs to me that would be a good first scene for this episode, wouldn't it? To begin this episode not with Feanor, but with... wait, where did we end the last episode? What was the final scene of the last episode? Was it Círdan fleeing from Eglarest? Is that where we ended the last episode? I think that was it. Círdan sailing off, right? So when we return to the Noldor here for the first time in several episodes, wouldn't it be fun to return not to Feanor but to the camp of Fingolfin and have Fingolfin and some others, Turgon and Fingon, suggest themselves? I mean, it seems like really sort of the inner council, right, of Fingolfin, his closest people, would be Fingon and Turgon, especially. But then also, you know, maybe including Finrod and Galadriel as well. So at least those two sons, and then maybe Finrod and Galadriel as well. Maybe this is a smaller conversation. Maybe this is just Turgon and Fingon and Fingolfin and Fingon and Turgon talking. They're expressing concerns, right? They're expressing concerns about Feanor, right? Like that he's going... Fingon would be able to be testifying, right? because he was just hanging out with Mithras, right? So he can say, you know, the whole scene could begin with Fingon returning from the ships of the Feanorians and saying, you know, Dad, can we talk? Like, I was just hanging out with Feanor, and, like, that dude ain't right, right? Like, there's something. He's getting worse. We might have to, you know, we're kind of following a lunatic here. Increasingly, it sort of looks like he is Fey, right? He is Fey and dangerous. Could be what could be Fingon's assessment, right? And yeah, even Mithras is concerned, Nick. Exactly, that he would say that. In fact, Nick, I was just thinking the same thing. This is tempting me actually to go back one step further and have a conversation between Mithras and Fingon, right? In fact, golly, it kind of seems like it's a shame not to have them have a conversation before they. Because the next time they're going to see each other is when Mithras is stapled to a wall. So, gosh, okay, actually, maybe that's where we should start. Maybe we should do that, because we want to have a farewell conversation, but they don't know it's a farewell conversation, so we have to set that up right. Yeah, I'm kind of liking that idea. So if we have if we start with the conversation between Fingon and Mithras, and all right. Anyway, my job is not to write the outline, so I don't want to get too detailed. However you guys think it's best to set it up. But I would like a conversation between Fingon and Mithras, and I apologize for misspeaking. I'm a little sleep deprived and am likely to misspeak, always likely to misspeak, but even more here talking about this stuff. Okay. Yeah, exactly, Marie. We turn to Fingon and Mithras' roles as peacemakers between their fathers. But see, Marie, what I'm thinking is the last conversation between Fingon and Mithras, they should have a fight, right? They should be arguing. As Fingon should be saying to Mithras, like, dude, you see your dad, right? Your dad is like, this isn't okay, right? I mean, like, you can see that your dad is going straight off the deep end, and Mithras would defend him to Fingon, right? Mithras would be like, oh, what are you talking about? Like, that's absurd. My dad's totally fine. And so we should have them part, not exactly parting in anger, they shouldn't be storming away, but the fact that the last conversation between them was an argument should really weigh heavily. The reason I want this, the reason I want that, is that it makes Fingon's decision later on even cooler, like much cooler, I think. Because if Fingon, so Mithras would never suspect that, you know, because he and Finrod departed in anger, right? And then Mithras, you know, and the Feanorians abandoned him, Fingon. So when Fingon is, anyway, you see how this kind of sets it up, right? And Mithras will feel bad when Feanor decides to abandon them, because he's like, now Fingon is going to think that, like, I have turned my back on him, you know. I like that. I like that. Okay, so they talk, and the concerns about Feanor come out there, and they depart in anger. Not like hatred or anything. It doesn't have to, you know, it don't come to blows or anything, but it's ugly. Like, they, you know, they're arguing. They're arguing because they're both defending their dads. And it's going to be the memory of that conversation, right? So this also sets up, of course, Mithras at the end of this episode as he watches his dad set fire to the ships, and the realization we can show in Mithras, like, holy cow, he was right. Like, Fingon was right and I was wrong. Dad's nuts, right? Nick wants Fingon to say he will kill you all one by one. Yeah, you should totally say that. Yeah, he will kill us, he will kill us all one by one. And then Mithras, that's going through Mithras' head later on. Yeah, I like that. In fact, maybe we could even just do that instead of having the conversation with Fingolfin. I mean, we would want to set up Fingolfin, I would be tempted still to have it, because have Fingon come back and report it, and have somebody like Turgon say, you know, Dad, you might have to step in at some point. Like, I know you swore this oath and everything. Like, I get it. But, you know, how long are we going to follow the leadership of a lunatic, right? You know, of a megalomaniacal lunatic. This isn't right. Like, we're going to have to stop him and have Fingolfin be actively considering that. This also, of course, sets up a really important point, which we'll need to come back to later, which is, why does Fingolfin make the decision to cross the Helcaraxa? What are his reasons? What are the reasons to go? Because it's not, it does not at all seem an inevitable thing to do. Yes. Hakon says, you have to save Feanor from himself, Dad. Yeah, you're right. That would totally be Targon's line, right? Wouldn't it, Hakon? That's very good. That's very good. You guys are awesome. Okay. So, after this happens, the night after this conversation, you know, the fiery conversation between Fingon and Mithros, the Feanorians are on board the ships. Feanor makes his decision, talking to Curufin, we should just slip away. We should leave them behind. They're going to betray us. If we're not careful, we're going to betray us. We are enough. We are strong enough. You know, the eight of us and our people, we can take Melkor down ourselves. This vengeance is ours, and it's not theirs anyway, and we can't trust them. So let's go. And then the wind picks up. And the wind picks up and blows them out to sea. Now, in the other ships, they don't realize they're leaving yet, right? They're ready to go. They're all in the ships, but you know, they're sort of assuming some arrangements are going to be made with the people on the shore. Again, everyone else other than Feanor and Curufin are assuming that they're the first wave of the shuttle service, right? And no arrangements have been made or whatever. But anyway, so they're pushed out to sea by the wind. Feanor signals to just go, right? Follow me. And they send the signals and they make it across. So we could even have Mithros on another ship receiving the signal from his father, right? And saying to the, you know, like, so he and, like, somebody else are there on that ship. Maybe him and Maglor are on this other ship, and they receive the signal and they're like, okay, you know, we're going. Okay, all right, so we're heading over. And then they go and they get to the other side. So now that's why they successfully slip out secretly. Nobody knows. It's unannounced. They don't make any extra noise doing it. You know, again, nobody, you know, like, says goodbye or blows a horn or anything else to sort of announce their departure. Which is the kind of thing you'd do, right, if you were not slipping away secretly. So that's how they end up over there. And then Feanor, has to make the announcement, right? Has to make the declaration over there. And this is when Mithros has this horrible experience, right, of realizing that his friend was right, that his dad has, in fact, lost it. And he's going to first oppose him and then stand aside when he can't sway his father. Now we come to the interesting Emrod question. So, context for this. For those of you who think it's a little bit odd that we're discussing the question of Feanor killing his son Emrod and burning him alive inside one of the ships, this is not an arbitrary idea. This is a Tolkien idea. This is a very late Tolkien idea. This is in the Peoples of Middle-earth, so it's volume 12 of the History of Middle-earth. Tolkien had suggested this sub-story. It didn't make it into the published Silmarillion. It's one of many ideas that Tolkien had later in his career that didn't get fully developed and didn't get, you know, things that he seemed to be thinking, maybe I'm going to go and I'm going to put this in, you know, I'm going to rewrite the stories around this, but he never got around to actually writing them. So they didn't get included in the published Silmarillion. But the story is that Amrod, they land, right? The Fëanorians land, and they're on the beach, right? So they set up a camp on the beach. Amrod says, "I'm going to go sleep in the ships." Right? He's like, I don't want to sleep on the beach. I'm going to go sleep in the ships. Then when they set fire to the ships, they burn Amrod alive. But the implication is, yeah, and as Marie says, it's in, if you look in the Peoples of Middle-earth, it's in what's called the Shibboleth of Fëanor. And it's, yeah, as she points out, it's barely a side note to the story of why the twins' names are both Umbarusa, right? So they, it's all about the names of the twins. It's Tolkien, right? So the whole story is a gloss on the meaning of the name, essentially. But there's also an implication that Fëanor kills him on purpose. That he suspects, at least, that Amrod was going to set off for home. And that the story there, it's been a long time since I've read this, so Marie, you can correct me if I'm misremembering it. But the issue is the connection between him and his mom, right? That Amrod is the one of the seven sons who is most attached to their mother and who most regrets leaving her behind. And so he's decided, or at least Fëanor has suspects that he's decided, I'm going to steal one of these ships back, and I'm going to return to Valinor, and I'm going to go back to Mom. And Fëanor, suspecting that Amrod is going to run away, aka betray him, knowingly sets fire to the ship with his son in it to kill his son rather than have his son betray him. Now, again, this is not in any way a fully developed story in Tolkien's Legendarium, but Tolkien is the source of this story. It's fairly sensational, and I know the outline team was excited to use this from the beginning. This was an early suggestion, by Marie, I think. Brianna says that the death of one of the twins is one of her favorite Tolkien revisions, and that it really adds to the story. I certainly agree. I want to make sure that it works symbolically. That is, we can easily make it work symbolically. Amrod, his youngest son, I mean, they're twins, I know, but Amrod is the younger of the twins, isn't he? Isn't that also, Marie reminded me in that sidebar in the Shibboleth, isn't that also what's being articulated there? Something about that. Anyway, sorry. He would be boarding it in advance. He wouldn't be boarding it while it's on fire. So no, the idea is they arrive and then they camp. So they're going to rest for that day. They're not going to send the ships back right away. So it's in the night when they slip away, you know, it's like evening of the next day by the time they get across and land. And so they camp on the beach overnight. Then the next morning, or that same night, because it's more dramatic to set fire to ships in the dark than during the day. But whatever. Okay, so that same night, or before dawn, at dawn the next day or whatever, while it's still dark enough for the burning of the ships to look awesome, they say, okay, like, so now we, you know, had a nice night's sleep on the beach. Okay, I know it's always dark. I know, right? Here, when we're talking about morning. See? Sleep deprivation, as I tell you. I'm remembering. Okay, so they get over there, and it's they sleep, right? And then they're like, okay, let's send the ships back over, right? But the point is, they've been there for a while. They don't just get there and then immediately disembark and then immediately send them back, right? Everybody disembarks from the ship. 100% disembarkation. Anchor the ships. Let's leave. And they all come to the shore because they're arriving in Middle-earth. It's a big moment, right? You know, Fëanor steps first off the ships and he is going to make a speech, right? He's like, you know, and I defy you, Morgoth, and, you know, and I claim this land for myself and various other megalomaniacal things I'm going to say. And then they set up a camp, right? A temporary camp, and he has everybody disembark, right? He wants everybody off the ships. So he tells everybody, like, this is our first, you know, this is our first night in Middle Earth. After our long, you know, exile in Valinor. So let's all come. So everybody is there. Amrod at that point, prior to the decision to burn the ships, then, if he's going to make a choice to get on a ship and try to and think about trying to steal one, he's going to get on the ship then, right? But he's going to sleep first. Everyone's all tuckered out, right? Because they've been sailing across the sea and everything. So, so Amrod goes to sleep on board the ship with the intention to take it back the next day. Yeah, I know, day. I get it. But I'm talking like after there are sleep cycles, right? They still, even in the darkness, they, you know, even under the starlight, the elves are going to have circadian rhythms, aren't they? of some kind, right? Even of an elvish kind, with, you know, walking in elvish sleep, in elvish dreams like Legolas does or whatever. Anyhow, the point is, he gets on board the ship. It's only after then, so he's the only one on board the ships, and nobody else knows that he's there, that they set fire to the ships. So, okay. I'm... There are a couple things that would have to happen in order to set this up, right? Thing number one. Håkon, exactly as you say, the closeness of Amrod to their mother is something that has to be set up. And it does seem a little weird to set that up now just at the last second, right? We might have to go back and rewrite a touching moment or two. In fact, could we introduce... It doesn't have to be a long conversation. Like, a few seconds, right? Of, for instance, a long lingering embrace between Amrod... and his mom, right? And then his brother, his twin, kind of pulling him away. We could do that. Exactly, Håkon. Before the kinslaying.
What about controversy over his departure? Maybe he doesn't want to go, or maybe Nernell doesn't want him to go.
Well, Nernell doesn't want any of them to go, right. But.
But what about sort of a? She doesn't want any of them to go, but she sort of gets like, you know, most of them are going to go. There's nothing she can do about it, but maybe she kind of says, at least leave me, Amrod.
Amrod, right? And we need to show Amrod's willingness, especially. Yeah. So if we. Plant the first seed of that back in episode one, in the departure from, Nerdinel. Boy, I'm even blanking on her name today. I need to sleep more. Yeah, Marie points out, Dave, Tolkien thought of exactly the same thing. Nerdinel not wanting him in particular to go is how Tolkien writes her farewell with Fëanor in the Shibboleth. So there you go. That's right. We could do that. We could show his and then we could show his unwillingness to go. And all we'd have to do is return to that. We just need a conversation between Amrod and Emras. Right? In which Amrod confesses. Because, see, here's the problem. If Amrod is totally on his own, again, we need somebody for him to talk to in order for the viewers to have any idea what he's planning to do when he gets back on board the boat. We could have it just be a tragedy, but see, I'm not... I don't think... All right, well, hang on. Let me just spell out these options more clearly. Option number one, accidental tragic death of Amrod, right? In which Amrod merely returns to the ship because he kind of likes... He's more comfortable on the ship and can't get comfortable. You know, so, like, he's just like, I'm tossing and turning here. You know, like, I don't like this beach, so I'm going to go and sleep on the ship because it's better on the ship, right? So he is innocently sleeping on the ship. They don't know that he's sleeping on the ship. They set fire to the ships, and then they're like, oops, Amrod was on the ship, and isn't that tragic, right? That's one option. The other option is that he is on the ship because he plans to depart. Feanor has some suspicion that he plans to depart and return to Nerdanel, and so he sets fire to the ship knowing that his son is on board the ship. This is an execution, not an accident. The accident thing, the tragic accident thing, could work. If we did that, then that would make Amrod like a symbol of like the death of Feanor's innocence, right? You know, it would be like he would be in his dying. It would be like, and there's like the symbol of Feanor's innocence and humanity being destroyed, right, in the burning of the ships, and that could kind of work, but I. And the other effect that it would have would be just to cast this sort of pall of horror over the whole event, right? As if it were like an immediate judgment upon Feanor's decision. Like, did you need confirmation that burning the ships was the wrong thing to do? Your confirmation comes in the form of the fact that you burned your own son alive accidentally by doing it, right? Like, that's a pretty clear indicator that was a bad thing to do. And you'd almost have to think it would put a lot of pressure on Feanor's response to that, right? Because if it was an accidental death, he would either be wrestling with remorse, or he would not be wrestling with remorse, right? Or he would be so far gone that he would just, like, what? Probably take this as another reason to hate the Valar. Like, this is confirmation that the Valar hate him and are conspiring against him, and he's not going to be dissuaded by, you know, the acts of petty vengeance against him by the Valar. Is kind of what I'm thinking Feanor would be thinking in that kind of a situation. So that could work.
I like that angle.
The other angle is the execution angle, right? So option two is Amrod is planning to leave, right? He's going to get a good night's sleep first, but he's planning to leave. He's going to, you know, as soon as he wakes, he is going to he's going to steal one of the ships, and he's going to set off for Valinor, and he's going to go back to Mum. And for this, we would need him to have a conversation with Amros in advance, presumably attempting to convince his twin to come with him. And Amros is like, no way, I'm staying with Dad. Don't do it. Now we would also need Feanor to learn about this. So Feanor overhears them, or Amros tells his dad, presumably thinking, Dad, help me talk him out of this, right? Like, Amrod is, you know, wanting to go back to Valinor, will you help me talk some sense into him? And Feanor's like, yeah, I'll talk some sense into him. And then, like, sets fire to the ships. And Amros would have to be really appalled at that. And Feanor would have to be even further gone than in other versions. Right? I mean, that's the other option.
I don't like this option as well, because I think it sort of paradoxically, as you point out, it actually reduces the horror.
Yeah.
Like I think it's less interesting. Fëanor, who intentionally burns his son, is kind of a caricature.
Right.
Whereas the Fëanor who makes this really bad decision and then unintentionally burns his son to death and then can't admit that he was wrong, but
right.
instead has to sort of retroactively justify his decision, I think ends up being much more interesting.
Right. Right.
He has more to wrestle with. In some sense, the conversations that he'll have afterward will be almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
If he does it intentionally, people are going to come and confront him and say, "You burned your son to death," and then he has to say various things to justify why he did it. If he accidentally burns his son to death, people come and say, "Oh no, you burned your son to death." He says exactly the same things. He still has to come up with a way to justify why he did it. But we actually get to see him on screen, sort of undergoing the sort of character development or the thought process
right.
that leads to him deciding why it was okay to burn his son to death. So
right.
I think I like the accidental. I'm in favor of the accidental option.
Yep, I agree. I agree, and I like that both Tony and Marie are suggesting a sort of a middle course where Amron does intend to leave. But Fëanor doesn't find out about it. The burning is still accidental. But that adds this sort of extra layer of tragedy, imagining the youngest of the Fëanorians, who is really kind of a mama's boy, and who wants to return, who is repenting, so you've got the one Fëanorian who actively attempts to repent and to return, to Valinor, and gets burned alive in the ships.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I agree with that. I think that definitely Amrod should be planning to betray him, so that part of his justification is the Valar turned my son against me. He betrayed me. That kind of stuff.
Well,
so basically, it's partially Amrod's fault.
But he wouldn't know.
Oh well, I'm thinking somebody should know and tell him.
Amros would have to know. I mean, in order for us to know, right, what he's thinking, unless he leaves a note, right, he'd have to have that conversation with Amros. Phil is also pointing out that could be played as Amrod breaking the oath. Amrod took the oath, right? Could the accident come up? So it happens. Fëanor doesn't know. He discovers that he's burned. He blames the Valar. Then Amros would confess. Wouldn't Amros confess? He was going to leave. He wanted to go back to Valinor, and then Fëanor would perhaps say, "Well." Yeah, okay, then he betrayed the oath, right? This is what happens. See, sons, this is the kind of thing that happens when you break the oath. I like that. I like that a lot. And because, as Marie says, that explains why no other son ever breaks the oath under any circumstances, right? Even when the circumstances get increasingly horrible. Yeah. So maybe it's a kind of confession by Amros, right? Amros is standing there in tears, as his twin has died, and he confesses to his father and brothers he was going to leave. He told me he was thinking of leaving, and Fëanor can then kind of harden and say he broke the oath. And I like this. Yeah. Okay, good. All right. I think that this is much better than the, I see. I don't like the,
I don't like the pure coincidence thing. I don't like the I'm comfortable, I'm uncomfortable on the beach, and so I just kind of rather sleep on the boat, and then I'm tragically that seems too serendipitous, you know? That seems too... There I feel like we're just kind of going out of our way like, the burning of the ships is tragic enough, right? Adding, like, a purely accidental happenstance death of one of the sons of Fëanor feels to me like gilding the lily at that point, right? I mean, it's like, do we need yet one more layer of tragedy on top of the burning of the ships? But this has a different function. I like that. I like that.
Yeah, this works well. It gives I think now it actually serves to advance Fëanor along his path.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, exactly. And doesn't, as I would fear, doesn't just distract from the other tragic elements of it. I mean, like, for instance, one tragic element that we don't want to lose is the significance of those ships. Right, you know, those ships are the Silmaril Silmarils of the Teleri. Right, these are the greatest works of their craft that they will never be able to do again, and Fëanor just sets fire to them, you know, for no good reason. Apart from the betrayal of his kin, of his own kin, the wanton destruction of the most beautiful ships ever to be made in the history of Arda is a huge deal all by itself. And I want to make sure that we don't totally lose that. And Marie, absolutely. Marie says that is what Círdan is for in this episode. That's why we have Círdan come across the burned out hulls of the ships, and have their mourning. Yeah. Yeah. And Brianna, absolutely. Maedhros, we have Maedhros really smoldering, right, in this episode. He is actively unhappy with his dad, right? He is now seeing his friend Fingon was correct. He is not, and the idea that Fëanor is going to end up turning around and kind of blaming Amrod for his own death because he swore the oath, you know, Maedhros, he's not going to be okay with that. And Amros, oh man, think about the impact on Amros. What are we going to do with Amros's character? If we kill off his twin brother in this kind of tragic way, that's going to leave a scar. You know, that's going to hurt. Amros is going to live with the fact that he helped, because Maedhros to decide, but you know, as we're reminded, nobody else does. Amros is going to have been wielding a torch that set fire to the ships with his brother on, right? But wait, if he knew, how could he do that? If he knew, he wouldn't, would he? Or maybe he thinks his brother's already gone.
I think Amros can't be involved.
Or Amros thinks that his brother was taking a ship, so he thinks his brother's already gone.
Why does he have to be involved in the burning? What if he just wakes up in the middle of it and comes and says, oh my God, what have you guys done?
Well, because, so, I mean, there's that line about Maedhros alone standing aside. That by itself doesn't deter me if we have good reasons. Fëanor's not going to set fire to the ships by himself.
No.
He's going to call them together and announce that they're going to set fire to the ships. Because we have to have the conversation with Maedhros, where Maedhros says, whom shall we fetch back first? Fingon the Valiant, right? Maedhros is the spokesperson of the vast majority of the Fëanorians, who are all assuming that they're sending the ships back. It's really just Fëanor and Curufin who are thinking they're, you know, who are already kind of down with the plan that they're not doing this. So there has to be a general convocation at the decision to burn the ships. So if Amros knows his brother, there are only two options. No, because the Amros would tell him, like, Amrod is aboard the ship. There's no way that Fëanor could do it accidentally with Amros there if Amros knows. So either Amros has to not know, or he has to not be there, or he has to believe that Amrod is already gone. He doesn't have to know which ship exactly Amrod is on, right? He doesn't have to see his brother to the ship.
So the reason I don't like that is I feel like that gets sort of weirdly unnecessarily complicated. You know, so what's he going to say? Wait, well, Amrod was going to take one of those ships, but I don't know which one.
I think it's... Did we count the ships carefully before we set fire to them? Yes, yeah.
Well, no, also, don't you think if he came and told, informed them, hey, Amrod's on one of those ships, on one of the ships, and he's leaving, I feel like Fëanor, this is part of the reason I don't like Fëanor intentionally burning him either.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's a weird thing to do. I feel like the more authentic reaction to that would be to search the ships and find Amrod and seize him.
Right.
And, like,
right.
Take him prisoner and then confront him. Like, I don't think Fëanor would burn him impersonally. I think Fëanor would want to seize him and confront him over the betrayal. You know, that's sort of Fëanor's character. Like,
yes,
that personal
agreed.
Confrontation, so I think Amros can't be there.
Agreed.
For some reason. I don't know why he's not there. But.
Or he doesn't know. I mean, because, again, the problem is, in order to convey Amrod's intention, our only choices are have him convey it, explain it to somebody, in which it'd have to be his twin, or have him leave a note.
What if he finds the note?
Finds the note, yeah. After the ships are already on fire.
I think, maybe we can have our cake and eat it too. Maybe he has a conversation where he confesses that he's thinking about going home, that he would like to go home, and that, you know, I think I'm going to talk to Dad tomorrow and see if I can get a ship and all this kind of stuff. And Amros is like, okay, well, you know, or maybe he's like, I think I'm going to go, and maybe Amros convinces him.
It's like, oh, yeah, let's talk about it in the morning.
Talk about it in the morning. And then Amrod just changes his mind and tries to sneak away or whatever, and then Amros finds the note.
Right. Yeah. See, Nick, I have the same reaction. That's exactly it. And, Nick says that he feels like the note is, as he says, a little teen movie. I feel the same way. I don't like the note. I feel like the note is hokey, but I'm trying to find a way around this. I guess it's enough to have the conversation. Have Amrod make his intention, his desire clear. I would like to leave. I would like to go home, and have Amros urge him to wait and talk to their dad about it when everybody wakes up. It's almost impossible for me not to say in the morning. And I hope you know what I mean by that. No sun implied. You know, talk to Dad about it tomorrow. Again, another word I'm not supposed to use. So Amros goes to sleep with the assumption that he's won the argument, that he's convinced Amrod to wait and talk to their father in the morning, but he hasn't, right? So we just show Amros departing. If we just show him going to the ship at that point, then we've established enough what it is that he wants to do that people will know, right?
how do the Fëanorians ever find out?
That he was on board the ship?
Yeah.
Well, they could see him. I mean, it would be, like, horrible.
We're going to do a scene of him standing on the burning ship,
and then
his arms.
And then being engulfed in flames? Yeah. Yeah. No. Nick suggests they could find his burnt carcass washed up on the beach, which is even worse. Okay. presumably, if they're setting fire to the ships, like, with flaming arrows, is, I assume, how they would do it, because the ships are at harbor, right? So having them standing on the beach and shooting flaming arrows at the ships, so the ships are already burning, we cut to Amros below decks, right? And he awakes to this smell of smoke and, like, you know, goes up and finds the ship on fire. And why can't he jump overboard? It has to be, like, I don't know, he has to be engulfed in flames fairly quickly. Or, well, he can't be trapped below decks. They have to see him, right? Yeah, because he can't just drown. I mean, the water's too shallow. It's too close to shore to just drown. I'll let the script folks work out these particular details. But I'm thinking, I think they have to see him. I think we have to have the horrible moment where Amros suspects that he's on board the ship and he's like, "Dad, no!" And then, like, and then they see Amrod, you know, and we don't have to actually show, like, his body on fire, but to show the ship that he is on engulfed in flame.
Do we really think this is better than the note?
Yeah, I do. It's more horrible. It's more horrible.
These seem like details that maybe you can let the writers suss out. You know, after they make an attempt at writing a scene, if it turns out to not work, you know, the showing him burning, we can go back to the note as a fallback.
Yeah, yeah. Lydia asks the very sensible question, why don't they notice he's missing during the decision to burn the ships? Yeah. I mean,
what if we've established him as the invisible brother?
Right, the one nobody ever thinks about anyway. And we could have Amros kind of looking around for him, but it's a big crowd, you know, and it's not like they're standing in ranks or something, yeah. Right? So, yeah, they're all kind of milling around. Amros alone notices that Amrod isn't there, and he's kind of looking around for him with increasing concern.
Maybe we can set this up by having him also miss the oath, so they have to track him down later and have him take it separately in a private ceremony. Amrod's gone again. Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. Megan is suggesting that they could just hear the screams of Amrod from below decks. There is something kind of chilling about just the screams of Amrod wafting over the sea, you know, to them. Yeah, lots of possibilities. I agree. We can't get too into the details. We'll have to see, you know, how the flow of the scene goes as they're actually scripting it out.
But I think the central idea is Amrod does in fact plan to betray Feanor, but Feanor yes. doesn't know, so he doesn't
yes.
execute him or punish
yes.
him.
But blames him for his own death after the fact
right,
for breaking
right.
the
yes,
oath.
Exactly. He confesses his intention to Amros in some form so that Amros in one way or another. Once the ships are burning, so that Amros doesn't know for a fact that Amrod's on the ship, so he's not also intentionally burning his brother, but it becomes readily apparent to him very quickly once the ships are aflame that Amrod was on them. And then he's the one that reveals this information to Feanor and his sons and his hangers-on. Mm-hmm. And then what we get to observe is a spectrum of reactions. We get to see sort of the Feanor hardening his heart, and blaming the victim. We get to see Maedhros feels horror, Amros feels guilt. I assume Corfin is probably following along with Feanor, blaming Amrod and the Valar and stuff.
Yes, yes. And both Brianna and Marie are pointing out very appropriately, remember, this is Dringis. This is Lamoth. Morgoth's screams are still echoing around here. So the idea of Amrod's screams joining with the echoes of Morgoth's screams, that's good. That works well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Tony, I was thinking the same thing. Tony's thinking forward to how are we going to kill off Amros, because that's now, I mean, this makes Amros a much more prominent character, right? We've given him a real story, and we need to make sure that we follow it up. And none of the other sons of Feanor die prior to the fall of Doriath, right? I mean, there's like this uncanny survival rate among the sons of Feanor. Normally he's killed both Amrod and Amros in the published Silmarillion are killed in the attack on the Havens. But Tony is right that we need to come up with a suitable death for Amros. Well, just note to ourselves as we move forward, this can be a season 4 note. We need to think about the character arc of Amros, because, you know, having lost his twin in this way, his relationship to the Oath of Feanor, his relationship to his dad, his relationship to the Oath, his relationship to his other brothers, they're not going to be unchanged, right? We have to think about how that goes and what that's going to imply for his. Is he going to be? See, I'm now resistant to having him die there. I agree that there is a really interesting irony. Phil Boswell's pointing out the interesting irony of having Amros die among the ships at the Havens, right? Like his twin. I agree with that, but I'm not sure that, I mean, is Amros going to go along with the Oath? I'm not sure that Amros is not going to break from the family. I mean, this is a big deal. This is a big moment. I'm not sure he's going to be quite okay with his dad or view the Oath in quite the same way hereafter. We'll have to think about that, but we don't have to decide that today. Okay. Phil, I know you're right. It is possible that with his twin having just died from trying to break the Oath, apparently, would he double down on the Oath? That's conceivable. But I don't like that. I think that he's clearly going to be on the side of his twin. And when his father sort of turns against his twin, he's, you know, in the midst of his shock and horror and the death of his brother, which is going to hit him harder than anyone else because they're twins, as he's there in just shock and grief at the loss of his twin, there's his father blaming his twin, saying that he brought it on himself. Like, that's not okay. He's not going to be okay with that. Brianna, certainly at the least, he's going to be with Mithros, definitely. But I'm not sure he wouldn't go past Mithros. Because Mithros has other complicated reasons for wanting to sort of stay. Because he's his father's heir, right? He's the eldest of the sons, and I don't know. But like I said, we don't have to decide that now. We can certainly show Amros being especially fiery in battles against the orcs, right? I mean, we can have, you know, Amros going all berserker on the battlefield in the next episode. I don't think we need to go too much further than that. But anyway, we can punt this at least a couple episodes, if not into next season. Okay, let's go back to Fingolfin. Okay, so the host of Fingolfin has that moment that I was really wanting to preserve where they wake up and look out into the, on the beaches and see that the ships are gone. So debate ensues. Are the Feanorians coming back, or is this the first betrayal of the doom that Mando spoke of? We're going to have people, so there are going to be a number of people, of course, among the host who are pretty anti-Feanorian to begin with, who are going to very quickly suspect that this is a betrayal. And but there's no, who's going to be holding out? Fingon, right? Fingon is going to be the leader, the spokesperson for those who is most convinced that the Feanorians have not betrayed them. And he's, who's going to be the spokesperson on the side of, see, this is the doom coming true. They've totally betrayed us. Who's going to be most convinced of the betrayal of Feanor? Galadriel? Yeah, Tony was thinking the same thing. Galadriel. Have Galadriel be the spokesperson for they've betrayed us. This is it. That's also kind of nice because she's correct, right? So having her have this, like, you know, semi-premonition of what has happened, and then have Fingon be speaking against that because of his loyalty. The ship burning. I love the idea of a vision or dream revealing the ship burning to them. And I'm thinking Turgon should be the one who has the vision. Sorry. I apologize for the typo on Turgon's name there. If Turgon has the vision to confirm that... Yeah. Oh, and David is asking if people are going to be skeptical of Galadriel because she's so young. Well, maybe, but she wouldn't be the only person. I mean, she would be speaking for the majority, frankly. I would think that the majority of the people of Fingolfin are kind of dubious, at the very least, of Feanor and the Feanorians. And Turgon would quickly side with her. And Fingolfin would be kind of, you know, neutral.
Fingolfin is referee in the debate.
Yeah. I mean, he's trying to... you know, be fair. And they're still uncertain. And, you know, so he would say, his response, right, would have to be, let's wait and see. You know, all we can do is wait and see, you know, they may return. And Fingon would be like, yeah, they're totally returning. And you know, so they'll wait and see. And then as they're waiting and seeing, the vision comes to Turgon, just the vision of the burning ships. And he's like, okay, no, it's pretty much official. Were abandoned, and Fingolfin accepts it at that point. Now, this last point on this slide, I think, is a really interesting one. The decision to cross the Helcaraxa is separate from the decision to continue after the doom of Mandos, and does not happen immediately after they realize the ships are not coming back. They travel north along the shore. First of all, one thing I think... I like this idea of separating these two decisions. If I don't think the choice should be a binary choice between cross the Helcaraxa or return to Valinor yet, right? Mostly because I want to really highlight the Helcaraxa and the choice to set off. As we were discussing before, their abandonment on the shores of Ahriman gives them every reason, every excuse, not just excuse, every reason, returning to Valinor is the obvious thing to do. They have been left behind. Somebody can say, right? Turgon can tell his father, you're clearly freed from your oath, right? You know, if your oath was to follow and obey Feanor, he has abandoned you. You know, he has said, he has expressed that he wants you to stay behind. Brianna, I don't think they can see the glow of the flames across the water. I think the sea is still too wide at that point. Because even the Helcaraxa, I think, needs to be wider than that, than visual distance. And I think that they're not quite there yet. Why
but isn't,
does
isn't,
Fingolfin isn't go?
Part of the, isn't the physical distance between Middle Earth and Valinor kind of sort of weird and fuzzy anyway, right? Like, they could be far apart, but that wouldn't necessarily stop them from kind of seeing the flames. Maybe be a magic or something.
And, of course, if the Earth is still flat. right? I mean...
True. Even if it, but I think they don't have to see them, but then maybe that's Turgon's vision.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I kind of like the Turgon's vision thing.
The part of me that thinks that they shouldn't get, they certainly, even if they can see something, they shouldn't receive any kind of confirmation, they shouldn't be able to confirm it. There should just be just enough information, whether it's via, hey, I see some kind of weird light coming over the horizon, or it's Turgon's dream. It should be just enough information that all of their worst suspicions are sort of provoked.
Yes.
They're all like, oh,
right.
No.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, they've already been having the debate, right? So it's, but essentially, this, like, the vision of Turgon, which I favor over the seeing of any kind of remote visual phenomenon. I think that the vision of Turgon basically sways it, and even Fingon reluctantly is forced to agree, especially over time, that okay, they're not coming back now. Fingon would be quick to blame Feanor, and he would try to kind of moderate things by saying, look, I told you guys Feanor is nuts. Apparently he's even more nuts than I thought he was. And, you know, and his, not even his sons are to blame. This is all on Feanor, and everyone else is kind of grumbling and not necessarily agreeing with that. But, I think that they, but again, here's my question, though. The crossing of the Helcaraxa is a really big deal. Why do they do it? Why do they go on? Why do they choose to do that? What's their motivation?
Pride.
Pride?
Well, I'm thinking... Okay, so I guess there's two separate questions. The first one is, why do they want to go at all? I guess if one nice thing about this moment, sort of going back to the way we originally started, the way we started talking about sort of the wind and why that actually is an important, important role in Dolphin's character, that it makes it his decision. If they went because the ship showed up and they just got on, that wouldn't be very interesting. So why do they go? And then the second question, I think, is what are the circumstances under which do they go? Do they depart across the Helcaraxa knowing full well that the ships are burned and there's no other way for them to get there? Or do they kind of start to begin to suspect because of their suspicions and Turgon's dream and all that, and they're just like, you know what? I don't think they're coming back. You know, well, to heck with them. We don't want their ships anyway. We'll find our own way across. And maybe there's some people saying, no way, we should wait for the ships. I actually think, I'm setting aside, I guess, the question of why do they go, but I think it's more interesting if they depart without certainty that the ships are gone. That they don't just say, well, we have to cross the Helcaraxa. They decide we don't even want to take the ships, even if there were ships. We don't think there are ships. We don't know, but screw it. We don't want the ships anyway.
You are right that, as we were talking about with the wind, one really important element here is the fact that this is their independent choice. Right, they go to Middle-earth not because they're following Feanor, but because they choose totally independently of the choice of Feanor, right? Even choose against the odds, like to undertake, not just like we're going off into exile, we're going off into uncertainty, but we are willing to endure something really horrible and really dangerous for the sake of going over. Like, it is worth crossing the Helcaraxa to us to go over there. The decision is a really firm decision. You can't just cross the Helcaraxa because you've got nothing else to do, right? Because it seems like the path of least resistance. If there's one thing the Helcaraxa is, it is not the path of least resistance, right? So you can't just be like, well, it seems like the thing to do. Let's carry on, right? So again, Dave, I'm agreeing with you in saying, is this really shines a spotlight on the positive choice. We're going to go, we're owning this decision, right? To go over there.
So the question is, why do they go, like, is it enough to have this decision be a confirmation of the sort of familial loyalty, which is sort of originally what Fingolfin said, I'll follow you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Or do they need something beyond that? Is this sort of where they kind of go beyond the we're falling out of loyalty, and do they have their own independent reasons for killing us?
Well, I think they have to. I mean, the thing we haven't talked about, you know, as Tony was just mentioning, they're going to be ticked off, right? I mean, they're going to want...
Yeah.
So now, in addition to we want to take revenge on Morgoth, and we'd kind of like to set up our own kingdoms in Middle-earth, which we know to be a bigger motivation in the minds of some people, like Finrod and Galadriel especially, we have now the additional, we are mad at Feanor, and we want to go back. There should be some who say we should go and take vengeance on Feanor. Who would say that? We need a character to actually utter that if we're going to go there. Who should be the spokesperson for vengeance against Feanor?
I don't know if it's in character for Fingolfin, but I really there's part of me that's starting. I kind of like the idea of what if we give Fingolfin his Feanor moment here, where he makes a speech and whips up his followers into crossing the Helcaraxa. I don't know if Fingolfin should be the guy that says pledges revenge against Feanor, but there's part of me that kind of likes that idea, and I almost feel like it has to be him. Even if somebody else suggests it, Fingolfin has to be, like, we can't have somebody steal his leadership, so I guess it's got to be him.
Yes. Yes, agreed. He has to be the one who is making the... I agree. We have to give him the speech which sets them off across the Helcaraxa. Definitely. The person who says we should go to take vengeance on Feanor needs to be a bit of an outlier, right?
Galadriel.
That fits our feistier, angrier, more mistake-prone Galadriel character, but no one's going to like that idea.
Wait, why will no one like that idea?
No, people didn't. Lots of people would. Orodreth. That's hilarious, Tony. I love that idea. Orodreth, who is like the most namby-pamby of all of the third-generation elves in the Silmarillion. The idea of Orodreth being like slavering for blood, I think is really... I love that idea. I think that's hysterical. I mean, Orodreth's character could use a little adrenaline injection, I think. Is there anyone among the grandsons of Finwë who is more passive, the grandchildren of Finwë is more passive than Orodreth? I say this, of course, because Orodreth is famous for two things, right? Sitting by and letting Nargothrond get usurped by the Sons of Feanor first, and then sitting by and letting Turin run the show when Turin shows up.
He doesn't have a great track record of leadership.
No.
We'd really be setting the audience... If we made him into the, like, you know, come on, Fingolfin, we should go across there and get Feanor... We'd really be setting the audience up for disappointment later.
Yeah. It would complicate his relationship with Celegorm and Curufin later on. Finrod would give them sanctuary, is one who gives them sanctuary in Nargothrond. Which Orodreth would not be happy about, and then they usurp his position. So then we would have him, we would shift him away from being spineless to just being powerless, basically just be impotent, right? Yeah, so he's dead set against the Feanor, there's just nothing he can do about it, yeah.
I was about to propose Finrod, maybe, but I think you're right. I think I don't think we can have him be the let's get revenge on the Sons of Feanor. Oh, by all means, have sanctuary in my city.
Right.
It doesn't make much sense. Unless that's sort of an older, wiser Finrod who repents his earlier bloodthirstiness, which it can be doable.
Yeah.
But like certainly a kind of a vengeance driven Finrod here seems consistent with sort of the Finrod who cast his crown aside.
Yes.
Nobody will support him. Helping out Baron. So
yeah, we can't make him bloodthirsty. I agree. Oakwick was just suggesting the thing that I was thinking. What about having this be the opportunity to bring forward a character we haven't used yet, Angrod? So Angrod, son of Finarfin, he gets two moments in the published Silmarillion, right? The first is the moment where he's the one who comes and conveys Thingol's message to the rest of the Noldor. Saying, Thingol says hi and he'll let you stay in his lands. But anyway, he conveys Thingol's not very polite message to the Noldor. And he's the one that Caranthir then yells at, right? He calls him a talebearer and suggests that he's a weasel. And then Angrod, is also then the one who speaks up and says and tells Thingol the whole story of the kinslaying down the road. So, we need to start setting up Angrod and Ignor, because they're going to die soon in the Dagor Bragalach. And Ignor, of course, we're going to get more of, because we're going to get his relationship with Andreth. So we'll get the tragic, requited but unfulfilled love story of Ignor and Andreth. The interracial love affair that didn't pan out. So he's got a story, but Angrod doesn't have anything else. So yeah, Angrod, that works. Marie, I don't think we need to bring in. I don't think we need to bring in other. I think we've got enough third generation elves. I don't think we want to bring in others. Let me say it this way. As long as we have characters from the published Silmarillion whom we're not yet using, we should use those, right? In preference to any others. So let's make it Angrod. That makes sense. So Angrod is like, we should go and take vengeance on Feanor. And Fingolfin is going to make his... Okay, well, so, Dave, what do you think about my point about the separation, though? Because I'm thinking this needs to be my first thought is that this needs to be a two-stage decision. One stage, they wake up and the ships are gone. They have two choices. They either keep walking. They're not at the Helcaraxa yet, right? So they're not actually confronted with the Helcaraxa itself. And keep in mind, do they know it's there? Do they know what it's like? Right, they surely will not have heard anything but the dimmest rumors about what the Helcaraxa is actually like. Right, so until they see it, I think that they shouldn't know what it means to continue walking north. So their question is: do we walk north or do we go south? That is, do we return to Valinor? And I think that many of them will feel that they can't return to Valinor, like that ship has sailed. Right, they can't, so to speak, they can't go, but it's too late. The doom has been passed on them. They're guilty of the kinslaying. Many of them know it, or many of them are guilty of the kinslaying and know it. So they think they can't do that. So they're like, well, their first decision I apologize to the Twitch chat who are talking about it. Typo on the slide. My apologies for the spelling of the name of Turgon. Anyway, so they continue marching north, but they don't yet know about the Helcaraxa. So their first decision can be kind of passive, right? They're willing to go on, but they don't yet know what it costs. I feel like that moment for them is almost like Bilbo's moment at the beginning of chapter 5, right? go back, right? Go sideways? Impossible. Go on? Only thing to do, right? You know, so they're just going to keep walking. What else can they do? Unless they're going to go back to... So the first decision is, do we just turn around right now and go back to Valinor? And they decide no. So the first decision is not to go to Valinor, but to go on instead. And then they come to the Helcarax. Then they're going to come to the... They don't do this in this episode, but then they're going to come to the Helcaraxa. And when they come to the Helcaraxa, now it's clear. Okay, when you say you're going to go on, are you willing to pay the price, right? Are you willing to go on when you see that the road is this bad? Are you willing to undertake the crossing of the Helcarax? Is going to Middle-earth worth that much to you? Or will you now turn back, right? How committed are you to the concept of going to Middle-earth? Is it worth it? Because to me, that's the...
By the way, can we have them have a debate that alludes to Bilbo's monologue there?
That would be really fun.
Do we go south? Do we go west?
Impossible. Yeah. Yeah, that would be fun. So the reason I think that I'm wanting to separate these things into two different decisions is that I want to separate the two choices. First, the choice, do we return to Valinor? That should be the operative question when they wake up and the ships are gone, right? Do we return to Valinor? So they've made the decision, no, we're not going to return to Valinor. We don't think we can return to Valinor. Then the second one is it worth it? Are you willing to pay the cost? Are you willing to go to Middle-earth despite the fact that many of you are going to die? Is it worth braving the Helcaraxa to go? Are you willing to sacrifice to get to Middle-earth?
So when they head north initially, that's sort of just a default, right? Like they're heading north not with the expectation that they'll be able to get to Middle-earth. They're heading north because they feel like there's no place else to go.
No, I think they know. I think that they've heard stories that there is a land bridge. They know that a land bridge exists.
But maybe they're heading up there thinking that there's like a nice short like paved road, like a highway across underwater metro or something.
Right. Well,
I heard there's a way to get to north up there. Yeah, it should be fine. And this and that. But I think the main idea is the reality of crossing. Really?
Yes.
They don't really understand that until they get up there and they see it. And then
yes.
And is that where Angrod comes in? Maybe Angrod doesn't really have much to say until they get up there and they see the Helcaraxa, and then people really start waffling. And Fingolfin starts waffling. Like Fingolfin is wrestling with the what's best for my people.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's when Angrod whispers in his ear and says, you know, hey, we need to teach this Fëanor the lesson.
Angrod would be among those who is willing to go. But see, that's exactly the point. Why are you going? Why are you willing to sacrifice to go to Middle-earth? What is I'm sounding to myself like Miracle Max in the back. What is worth living for? You know, what do you want to come back for? Like, that's exactly it. Are they going over for bad reasons? Is it their desire for vengeance that drives them across the Helcaraxa? Because that's really bad, right? I mean, that's not a good reason to cross the Helcaraxa. Is it for the sake of helping the Fëanorian, like rescuing the rest of the Fëanorians from the madman Fëanor? That's a better reason. Is it to fight Morgoth and try to save Middle-earth? That's a good reason. There are lots of reasons, better and worse, but really, I think it's not until they're confronted with the Helcaraxa itself and they realize what it's going to cost that they have to choose, like, why are we really doing this? So yeah, Dave, I think they've heard stories. They know there's a land bridge. They maybe have heard rumors that it's kind of rough, right? But there's been a 0% Valar mortality rate in crossing it in the past, right? So no elf has tried to do this before. So there's no reason that they would have an accurate sense of exactly how dangerous it's going to be. So they're going north with the intention of crossing to Middle-earth and with probably the vague understanding that it's going to be challenging.
Right.
But they don't,
When does Turgon's dream come in? So what's sort of the sequence of events here? First, Fëanor departs, and then do they remain waiting there until they get sort of as much confirmation as they'll get about of the ships burning, or
yes.
does Feanor depart and then they depart for the north, and then somewhere along the way Turgon has his dream and they like, I'm just wondering, like, is it that they remain waiting until they start to suspect the ships burn, and that's when they go looking for another way? Or do they head north first, they get up, see the hell cracks and think, yikes, you can't do that, maybe we should go back and wait for the ships. Then Turgon shows up and says, there aren't any ships coming.
Yeah.
And then that's when they have to decide.
Great question. Let me first come back to a small point, that is, why I don't want them to see the light of the ships. I know that it says that in the book. I know that it says it in the book that they see the light of the ships burning from afar and know that they were betrayed. Let me explain the reason I don't want to do it that way. This is, to me, another issue of translation to the visual medium. Again, it's one thing to say that. It's another thing to show it. If we show on screen, so picture it now. Picture on screen Fingolfin and the others standing on the shore, looking out to the east across the water, and they're seeing the glow of the burning ships on the horizon, right? Now,
it's going to look like the ocean is 1 mile wide.
Exactly. That's exactly the effect. Now,
it's going to look ridiculous.
We can explain it away. We can explain it away. The world is flat, not round, right? So you can see further. They're elves. They can see, you know, Legolas can tell the difference between a sparrow and a finch a league off, right? They can see really far. But we have to explain all that, right? I mean, it's still...
That'll be a great scene in the show. Like, look, Feanor's burning our ships on the coast of Middle-earth. Wait, how far? Isn't that like hundreds of miles? Yes, but we have elvish
sight. But we have elvish sight and can see that. Yeah, yeah, I mean...
That's what you want in a dramatic
sense. Exactly. I mean, it's going to be impossible for our viewers who are seeing it themselves, right? Not because we're not seeing it through the eyes of the elves. The viewers are seeing it from, you know, through the camera, right? So it's going to look like it's really short. And honestly, the question of, like, why don't we, like, build some rafts or something? Like, let's just, like, can't we, like, you know, we're elves. We live along, you know, can't we, like, burn out some canoes and sail over, you know, go over, like, the, you know, the Polynesians or something? I mean, you'd think that would be plan A if the sea is as narrow as it's going to look if we have them see this. So that's why it is for the sake, again, it's in my judgment, that is another one of those effects which creates a really good effect in print and in the imagination, but when you actually see it on screen, I think it's going to undermine the effect. I think that we... So that's why I don't want to do that. And that's why I am very willing to fall back on the second choice, which is a very Tolkienian option as well. Somebody having a dream of an event that's happening elsewhere is a thing that happens all the time. It's just like Frodo's dreams. It's just like Bilbo's dream in the Goblin Cave, right? This is a thing. Having what I call a current events dream is a thing in Tolkien. When a vision comes to you of something that is happening far away or something that recently happened far away or whatever. So I think that and as Marie is pointing out, the Helcaraxa has to be a very long, hard journey, right? It can't just be a few miles. All right. So that's why I want to change the bit about them seeing the glow of the light. But Dave, to your sequence question is a great one. Here's my vote. My vote is, they wake up, they immediately have the debate. There are some who are like, we were abandoned. Galadriel says, they're gone. They're not coming back. We've been abandoned. And Fingon says, no, like, they're coming back. Mythos wouldn't do that. Like, their dad's a little crazy, I'll grant you that, but they're sending the ships back. Trust me. I think people side with Fingon. Or at least give them the... Like, Fingolfin sides with Fingon, his oldest son. He's like, okay, all right, Fingon, like, I will... Like, you're the one who knows them. You've spent the most time with them. I will lean upon your judgment here. And Fingon feels justified. and they're waiting. So he's like, trust me, they're totally coming. Ships, any minute now, we're going to see the ships. It's totally going to happen. And they wait. And they wait for not too long. I'm thinking a short period of time, but long enough for everybody else to start looking at each other. You know, it's been like, I don't know, again, how do you measure time? Because there's no sun and moon. But they've been around for some time there on the shore. People are starting to grumble, but Fingon, with flagging confidence, is still insisting that they're going to come back. And then Turgon has his dream. And Turgon has his dream, and in his dream, he sees the ships burning. And he wakes, and he tells his dad and Fingon, he's like, Fingon, they're not coming. They burn, you know, Feanor burned the ships. And everybody believes him. Because it's Turgon. And it's the kind of thing that happens. So, Tony, exactly. Galadriel has a kind of Cassandra moment there. Yeah. Yeah, it's a little Cassandra-ish. It's not totally Cassandra-ish. Like, it's not like everybody disbelieves her. There's many people who feel the same way that she does. But, yeah, the idea that she has some kind of foresight, I think, is good. She turns out to be right. I think that's nice. And it fits with her character, too, that she is anti-fan or anyhow. So she's going to be quicker than many to think the worst of Feanor. So I think it makes sense on several levels. All right. So then Turgon says he's... And then that decides Fingolfin. So then they have to make the first decision. Do they go back or do they go on? And they decide to go on. To the Helcaraxa, and then it's not going to be until the next episode that they come to the Helcaraxa and make their second and final decision. So that first decision is simply, we can't return. We need to keep going, even though Feanor has left us behind. And we can even have some saying of Feanor, just what Feanor was saying of Fingolfin, good riddance, right? I'm glad we're out from underneath the leadership of that madman. Okay. all right, good. Let's keep going. I think I have several more slides, but we're getting to the tail end of the action here. These are the more minor events. So we've got Círdan. So remember in the previous episode, we had the Philothrim being destroyed by the army, chiefly the army of werewolves. So the Philothrim are on their ships along the coast, but they don't see the fleet of swan ships sailed by the Feanorians into the Firth of Dringist. You will remember, going back to our map here, that we had, so we have, here's the Falas down here, right? Here's the where they're fleeing from. So they just fled from here, and they've sailed north up the coast with some a design on scouting, seeing if their army's massing up here and stuff, right? We're, you know, doing some kind of reconnaissance. And we had them taking temporary refuge on this island here at the mouth of the Firth of Dringist. So they're here on this island, but they don't see the... Or like they arrive there presumably after, I guess, Feanor sails by. But in any case, they don't see Feanor at sea. But they're here on the shore so that they can see the glow of the ships burning. So we still get that image of the glow of the ships, but they don't know what it means, right? So then they sail over from the island, but by the time they get there, the ships have been burned and the Feanorians have left. So all they find are the burned out hulks of the... The burned out hulks of the Feanorian ships. Of the ships. And Marie, as you said, this is when we get first and foremost the lament of Círdan over the destruction of the ships of the Teleri. He will recognize Círdan, the shipwright, better than anybody else, right, will recognize these are the most beautiful ships that will ever be constructed in the history of Middle-earth, right? In the history of Arda. And they will mourn for them, and they clearly must assume that it's like orcs who destroyed them, right? Clearly, this is work of the enemy. I think somebody. Oops, we have no other named characters with Círdan, do we? But anyway, somebody asks Círdan, who would have done such a thing? Right. Somebody has to say that. Somebody has to say, like, you know, but who would have done such a horrible thing? And Círdan would say, you know, I don't know, you know, but it must be the enemy. Ooh, yeah, Tony, you're right. We do have somebody. Galdor. Galdor, the elf from the Havens who comes to the Council of Elrond. You're right. Yeah. We have another elf from another named elf from the Havens who has to survive, of course, in order to make it to the Council of Elrond.
We should always remember the scenes in Rivendell. There's lots of named elves wandering around that don't have much to do.
Yes, it's true. We have to come up with Aristor at some point, right? He's the elf of Elrond's house who speaks up at the council. So we've got to introduce him at some point, sooner or later. Doesn't have to be sooner. Galdor. Okay, so he's talking to Galdor, and Galdor says, "Who would do such a thing?" And Círdan can say, "I don't know anyone who would do such a thing, but it must be the orcs." And then, yes, we have to have Gothmog. He sees the fires from a distance. You know, maybe one of the Balrogs comes in and is like, "My lord," you know, and then he sees the fire and.
And then Gothmog and Morgoth have a conversation where they say, "Oh, that's so terrible! What beautiful ships! Who would do such a thing?"
Yeah, exactly. Gothmog would be very sensitive to this point.
Actually, maybe their conversation is, "Wait, who did? That's our job."
That's right. Hey.
Who else would do such a thing? Círdan's asking who would do such a horrible thing, and Morgoth asking who else would do such a horrible thing.
Yeah, that's great. So Gothmog remembers. So Gothmog has been positioned in the north because, in order to wait for the Noldor to come, right? In case the Noldor come, so he's been waiting for something like this, not burning of the ships, but he's been waiting for their arrival. I kind of like the image of, you know, so I'm having this image of Gothmog looking at what is obviously a huge conflagration off over the horizon. And which, of course, you'd like the Balrogs, they'd be all in favor of that, right? They'd be very pro-conflagration in general. He wouldn't have to know what's happening, but have him look at the glow of the flame on the shore and have Gothmog, you know, smile evilly and say, you know, "Excellent," or something like that. Express approval. And just leave it, you know, unspecified what exactly his approval is of. You know, of course, he's showing approval of the fact that his enemies have arrived and he's now got somebody to pound on, which he's been looking forward. You know, the waiting is over and the action begins, which he's in favor of. But at the same time, we, the viewers, would be able to see kind of the resonance between Fëanor's attitude and you know, the attitude of Morgoth and Gothmog. So the implicit, even if unknowing, approval of Fëanor's deed by Gothmog the Balrog would be a fitting piece of dramatic irony there, I think. All right, so that's good. So Círdan is just going to... So he's going to be mourning. Because he's going to have to assume also, right, that he would assume that there were a bunch of Teleri in those ships. Why wouldn't he? Especially since, remember, the last time he and Olwë parted, when Olwë sets off for Valinor, he and Olwë had a plan, right? They both had their callings. He's like, "I'm going to be the... You know, I'm going to be the east guy, and you're going to be the west guy, right? And we're going to establish the link between Valinor and Middle-earth. That's our calling. That's our job." So he sees a bunch of Teleri ships, and he's got to be thinking, "This is Olwë, right? Here was Olwë trying to come back. Here was, you know, some of the Teleri returning to Middle-earth to establish this link between Valinor and Middle-earth that we felt that it was our calling to do." And they got ambushed and destroyed. So he's going to be mourning the death of Olwë, maybe? Assuming that Olwë was in the ships? Then that gives us more delicious and tragic dramatic irony, right? Here's Círdan saying, "Oh, my you know, my kinsman always is slain. These wrecked ships, are the evidence that, you know, my kinsman has been killed, which of course they are, but like not the way that he thinks. Right. So he assumes, so he would be looking for bodies, wouldn't he? But not finding any. And probably drawing some kind of hideous conclusion from that, that there are no bodies. Because obviously there would be bodies, right? If this was an ambush and the ships are destroyed. Because obviously Kieran would be completely unable to conceive of what actually happened, right? Yeah, I know, Maria. I'm kind of resisting the temptation to have them find Amrod's body, right? And like wonder why was there only one elf who was killed, or one elf whose body was left? Amrod, who is a burned elf. Maybe they do. Maybe they find Amrod's body. I wouldn't think they'd be able to. I wouldn't think that Kieran would be able to CSI out the fact that it was a Noldor skeleton, would he? Would the Noldor and the Teleri differ so much that you could tell from his charred skeleton that he was Noldoran? I wouldn't think so. By his armor and weapons. Nah, he left those behind, Tony. Amrod went unarmed onto his ship. He was returning to Valinor. Right, he was turning his back on the whole warfare thing. He wouldn't have had any armor and weapons with him. Yeah, but also I think that Brianna's right. There's no way that Amros or even Maglor and Mythros would have left without the would have left the body. I mean, after they heard the screams, they wouldn't just walk off and leave the corpse there. So yeah, no, they would have. What? Buried him? Or something? Did we decide that? Do they bury folks? Yeah, they do. They'd raise a mound. Yeah, they'd raise a mound. So they'd have to find the mound. Right? But no, they would do that. There's no way Amros would just walk off and leave his brother's bones on board the ship. There's no way. Yeah. No. Everybody is suggesting different ways by which they would discover that they were Noldor. I don't want them to discover it. I don't want them to discover it. I kind of want to leave this in suspense. I want there to be a moment of horrible realization later on, when Kieran puts together what those burned ships actually meant. And I'm willing to delay that. I'm willing to delay that real far. I'm willing to delay that into season 4. I'm willing to delay that until the moment that he and Thingol are talking about the rumors about the... Remember when Kieran comes to Thingol with the rumors about the kinslaying? I'm thinking then. You know, that Kieran is like, wait a second, I heard rumors, and let me tell you, I am now looking at these burned ships in a totally different light. Right? He would find out later.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, he'd find out later I don't want him to have any reason to know what happened. He thinks,
What do you think he thinks happened?
He thinks that Olwë and some of the other Teleri came over to visit Círdan and the Elves of the Falas, and to reestablish their, you know, this is the fulfillment of their goal, or the first step anyway, of their goal to establish, you know, the two harbors, one in the east and one in the west, for elves to come to and from Middle Earth. And but it's gone horribly wrong.
What do we think he thinks happened? Does he think that they came across to visit and then got caught by the orcs?
Yeah. Ambushed by the orcs and slaughtered to a man. Yep. Yep.
All right. So it's not like he's initially filled with hope.
No.
And he thinks like, oh, the Teleri are here. And
no hope.
Can't find them.
The only hope.
He thinks something horrible happened And then later on, he finds out something even more horrible happened.
Exactly. He thinks something horrible happened. Maybe they would look. Maybe they would suspect, hey, perhaps they got away because we didn't find any corpses, right? But then they might equally be thinking, maybe they ate the corpses. I mean, remember, there were like enormous slavering wolves chased them out of the phallus, right? So I would think that they're
At least this would give Círdan like a this would give Círdan like I don't know exactly what we intend to do with him over the next season, but this would give him something to do. Círdan's mission to find the Teleri survivors.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. Círdan figuring out what's going on can definitely be a like subplot of season four. Absolutely, absolutely. Yep, yep. So no, the fact that they find no dead Teleri there would just lead them to imagine even more horrible things had happened, essentially. Okay, last point. Finarfin returns to Valinor also. And the Valar forgive them, but it's a frosty welcome. I agree. They lose the friendship of the Valar and the Teleri. I don't think we can have them halfway back. I think that... I think that the Valar are either going to forgive them or not let them back. I don't think that the Valar are going to be like, well, we'll let you come back, but we're still just going to hold a grudge forever. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that they, the Noldor who return, are going to be covered with shame. Finarfin, of course, being their spokesperson. I think that he's going to return in penitence. He will certainly not become king of the remaining Noldor because he will not accept he will not accept a crown. He would have a humble speech about how, you know, he is not going to sit in his father's seat as king of the Noldor. Even though he is going to, you know, be the leader of all of the Noldor who remain. But what if, wouldn't he do something? Wouldn't he make some kind of change? If we see them, the Noldor who return, changing Tirion, right? Tirion, remember, was gorgeous. Covered with gems and absolutely resplendent, right, with glory. I'm thinking they don't tear Tirion down, but I think that they, humble it, right? That I agree, Marie. Some of the Valar aren't going to be a unified front. Some of the Valar can be more grudging than others. Aule is going to be the most grudging. He's going to be the most injured and therefore the slowest to forgive of all of the Valar. I do think that their relationship has changed. I don't think that they are the favorite of Aule anymore. I would like to see them doing something symbolic to Tirion to sort of show, because Tirion is going to, the visual appearance of Tirion would be like representative of the pride of the Noldor, and I would want Finarfin to make an active step to humble that. Right? He's going to forswear. He's going to forswear arms. This will be important later, right? Because we're going to have the War of Wrath, but not for some time. He would forswear arms, I think, arms and armor, and they would. Yeah, exactly, Tony. I'm thinking of that too. Tearing down all the jewels and offering them as some kind of wear guild to the Teleri. I would think we would have to show that. I would think that we would have to show Finarfin. Remember, Finarfin's wife is there, right? Finarfin's father-in-law was killed. So we have to show Finarfin returning to Aucalonde.
Are you are you proposing that the Valar do something to Tyrion? Or,
no, the Noldor themselves.
Okay, yeah, I like that idea.
Act of repentance.
Like the idea, I don't know, I'm curious to know what you think of this. Kind of like the idea that the... I think that I'm sort of inclined along the lines of the Valar forgive them.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just seems like what they would do.
Yeah.
But I kind of like the idea of the Valar sort of saying, of the Valar proposing to Finarfin or convincing him to take to assume leadership, to take the you know, to become the leader.
Yeah.
But then kind of laying it on him to make things right.
They're, yes.
You know, basically telling him, you need to be king now, but just so you know that we're not giving you an honor. This is a really crappy job, actually.
Right.
This
right.
is like by becoming king, being king is part of your penance.
Yes.
You now are responsible for
oh, I like that.
Your people or restitution. Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Finarfin comes in and he's all like, I'm not worthy. I shall not sit on the throne of my father. And you know, I have lost any right I ever could possibly have had to lead my people. And Manwë says, yeah, no, you will. And it is part of your penance that you will, you must. Yeah, I like that. I like that. I like that a lot. And we've got to show him returning to Aqualondë, right? Here, now or later, we've got to show him returning to Aqualondë. We don't necessarily have to squeeze that into this episode. We could have his meeting with this conversation with Manwë be part of this episode, and have Finarfin's return to Aqualondë be part of a later episode, like perhaps when have that align with Fingolfin's decision to cross the Helcaraxa, for instance, suggests itself as one possibility. But I do think we need to bring Finarfin back to Aqualondë. We need to close that loop. The kinslaying has to be, it's not going to be totally solved, right? It's not going to, that loop doesn't get closed until after the War of Wrath. But we need to do something there, I think. Okay, good. All right. Well, I'm running out of time rapidly now. Whoops. That was a little too rapid. Hang on a second. We'll do that again. Okay, so I had one more slide, which was questions for next time. All right, here we go. So first off, we're still off our schedule a little bit. Next week, I'm going to be in Texas for TexMoot, which is going to be awesome. So we won't have a session next week. So our next session will be on January 19th. It will be 2 weeks from today. Today is off the schedule. Next time is off the schedule. So the plan is to return to the schedule after that. So we're going to have our next session on January the 19th. The following session will be the next week on January the 26th. And then we'll be back to the original posted schedule on GoToWebinar. So next session, Friday, January 19th, session after that, January 26th, 1 week later. So my questions for next time we get into battles. Question number one, how does the battle go in the north? How are the Balrogs involved? So we're going to, that is the central event of the battle in the north is the Noldor plowing through, you know, the Noldor mowing down the orcs like grass, right? So how are we going to manage that? Are we going to have Balrogs killed? We are now finally to the point where we have to make a decision on a point which is not a no-brainer. How destructible are we going to make Balrogs? So how are the Balrogs going to be involved in the battle? Are they not going to be involved in the battle or whatever? How do we want to have Balrogs killed in the battle? Is that a thing we want to do, or do we want to have there only be a small number of Balrogs and have them almost never killed? That's a decision we need to make next time. Second question, how does the battle go in the south, and how are the Ents involved? So we have the chief element of the battle in the south. So the battle in the south is going to be the orcs coming down on the eastern side, going into Osiriand and fighting the green elves. And the chief feature of the battle in the south is going to be the slaughter of the green elves. So we're going to have the battle in the north going very, very well, and the orcs being no match for the Noldor. And we're going to have the battle in the south going very, very badly, and having the green elves be no match for the orcs. But just like we have the question of if the battle's going to go really badly in the north, what are the Balrogs going to be doing? Do we show them losing or not? How do we handle that? In the south, we have the Ents, right, who have been traveling with the Green Elves and who are friends with the Green Elves. Treebeard is going to be at that battle. What do the elves? What do the Ents do? Do they? I mean, if the Green Elves are all being slaughtered, how is it that Treebeard and the rest of the Ents allow the Green Elves to be slaughtered? We have to figure that out. So that's the second question. Third, we're going to get to the crossing of the Helcaraxa. So now we need to continue to refine. We've talked about it some today. That second decision, confronted with the actual Helcaraxa and with the knowledge of what it's going to take and the level of sacrifice that's going to be required for them to cross the Helcaraxa, what are their reasons? So here we're going to need Angrod, but we're going to need others, right? What are the different voices that we're going to get? What are the ultimate reasons that Fingolfin uses? When Fingolfin makes his speech, as I agree with Dave, he needs to do, when Fingolfin makes his speech, we're crossing the Helcaraxa, folks, come with me. What is going to be his explicit rationale? All right? So those are the questions for next time. Any final thoughts, Dave?
Nope. Huh? I'm very, very excited to do the crossing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's... Also, I'm pretty excited about the I like I really, really enjoy exploring all these Philothrim storylines in Middle Earth that, you know, don't get a lot of screen time, as it were, in the published Silmarillion. So
absolutely,
yeah, I'm excited. And yeah, I'm very sad I won't be in Texmoot.
Yes, yeah, Texmoot is going to be awesome.
But the likelihood of me being at MythMoot 5 is steadily climbing. So
excellent.
That's a good thing.
Very good. That'll be wonderful. Yeah, it's going to be great. Yeah. So, and I agree with you. Again, this is the most fun. It's what I keep telling people about the Amazon series, you know, to people who say, like, why is Amazon doing it? There's no point. Peter Jackson just did it and it was fine. The whole point is that it's a completely different kind of storytelling. It's not just that you don't have to compress the events. It's that you don't have to compress the characters, right? I mean, you think of the decision that Jackson had to make to replace Glorfindel with Arwen. A lot of people don't like that. I think it's a very sensible choice because Glorfindel will do nothing for the whole rest of the story, right? So why introduce such a minor character when he's only going to have one scene eventually, you know, right? I mean, he's only going to have the one moment. Why not use that as an opportunity to introduce a character who's going to matter? So, I mean, I get that's the kind of decision you have to make when you're compressing the story in that way. But the beauty of being able to do the longer action, sequential, episodic, epic storytelling is that you don't have to do that. In fact, if anything, we can go the other way. So you think of the decisions we've been making about, you know, that list of characters, that list of the grandchildren of Finwë. Right, which confuses so many people. I mean, I've talked to so many people for whom the stumbling block of reading the Silmarillion is just keeping all the names straight, right? Because in the published Silmarillion, by and large, with only a few exceptions, that list is, you just kind of have to memorize it. I mean, even Fingon doesn't do that much. He gets his one moment, right? Well, two moments if you count his death, right? But he doesn't get that many moments. Even Fingon doesn't get that many moments, right? Finrod does. The whole, you know, most of the rest of the Sons of Fëanor don't get that many moments. It's just, it's hard. It's really difficult. And there's so many characters who are only names, nothing but names. And in telling stories like this, we get the opportunity, even if only in small ways, like making Angrod the spokesperson for the We Need to Take Vengeance on Fëanor faction. We get the opportunity to attach a story to what was only a name in the book and really kind of fill this out in a really fun and rewarding way. So I agree. Doing that, thinking about the Philothrim and, you know, as you say, what a kind of, you know, sort of marginal story that is, in the sense that it kind of takes place on the margins of the main story in the Silmarillion. And it is really fun to be able to approach it. So anyhow, I agree. This has been great fun.
Very quickly, just to remind everyone, I'm going to put this on Twitter. The next three films are 2 weeks from now, Jan 19, then immediately following the following week, Jan 26, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Then we're back on our normal schedule.
Then we're back on our normal schedule. Nine. Yeah. So it'll be exactly.
All right.
It'll be February 9th. That's the date.
That's 2 weeks after.
2 weeks after the 26th. Yep. Yep. That is correct.
All right. Remember that, everybody.
All right. Very good. Okay. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us. Great suggestions here today. I think we made a lot of excellent progress. And I will say, as always, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.